Hello again, Dr. Steve McKinley here with the Digital Ethics Podcast. This week we are looking at professional ethics, and this is podcast number 2. And if you like, you can work along, you can open up the PowerPoint slides, Professional Ethics Part 2, and work along with them, or if you want, you can just open those up a little bit later and have a look. Just bear in mind, there are a couple of tips for the quiz in the PowerPoints. I kind of like highlight them a little bit to help you out, but also I'll be talking about them as well. So let's get underway. Podcast number 2, Professional Ethics. Okay, so in this podcast, we're going to talk about two main areas in professional ethics, and that is codes of ethics and codes of conduct, and the concept of whistleblowing. So when is it permissible to blow the whistle, and at what points in time are we perhaps morally obligated to blow the whistle? I'm going to be working along through the PowerPoint slides, so if you want to open the PowerPoints and have a look at them, you can. Otherwise, no worries, you can look at them at a later date. But the podcast should sort of roughly coincide with the slides. So professional codes of ethics. As we already mentioned, a profession is often designated as a profession because it has a professional code of ethics that's strongly associated with it. And these codes of ethics first emerged in relation to the medical profession. So they've been around for a long, long time. The American Medical Association, and also the legal profession as well. So lawyers, solicitors, barristers, and the American Bar Association has a code of ethics, but also New Zealand legal profession would have strong codes of ethics as well. And so many of these professions have really formal codes of ethics and conduct that their members are expected to abide by. In the computer industry, the IT industry, there are a bunch of different IT societies and professional bodies that have codes of ethics associated with them. So we have the ACM, the Association of Computing. In New Zealand, we have, it used to be called the Computer Society of New Zealand, but now it's called the NZ Institute of IT Professionals. The Australian Computer Society, the ACS, has a really good code of conduct, code of ethics associated with it, and I'm not sure if I have the link. The link might be in the course outline, but I'll put the link up on the Moodle page for the Australian Computer Society code of ethics as well. It's quite a good one to have a look at, and there are other professional bodies in IT that have codes of ethics associated with them as well. So what's the purpose of a professional code of ethics? They're not like legal, so you can't kind of prosecute a member if they don't abide by the code of ethics. But they're really more to motivate members of the association in certain ways. So the Tavani text argues that there are four primary functions of ethics codes. The four primary functions are: one, to inspire, so that's to identify values and ideals to which members can aspire to; two, guide, so they can guide and provide standards of best practice on how professionals should behave and operate; also educate, so three, educate, informing members about the profession's values and standards; and then four, sometimes discipline members or hold members accountable. So those are the four main functions of a code of ethics within an industry like the IT industry. There's quite a few criticisms of ethical codes. Quite a few ethicists and philosophers criticize ethical codes. For example, Ladd, 1995, argues that ethical codes rest on a series of confusions that are intellectual and moral, more intellectual and moral confusions. So his argument has three kind of main criticisms, and that is that he argues that ethics is basically an open-ended, reflective, and critical activity. So you can't codify it, so you can't put it within a code of ethics. And some of that argument could be associated with the fact that IT and computing evolve so fast that once you write down a code of ethics, it's essentially out of date. Another argument that Ladd makes is that specific codes of ethics introduce confusions with respect to microethics versus macroethics. So what does that mean? Basically, that means microethics are the responsibilities that might apply to individuals individuals such as clients or individuals such as people working in the IT industry. And then macroethics are wider social problems that might apply to a group collectively or to within society itself as a whole. Then a third strand to Ladd's argument, critique of ethical codes, is that because codes can have a disciplinary function, they become more like legal requirements than ethical rules. There are, however, people, not surprisingly, that defend professional codes of conduct, and the most famous is Donald Gottebahn, who's a famous ethicist who I've met a couple of times, actually. He's a very good friend of my PhD supervisor, John Weckert, and so I met Don Gottebahn a couple of times some years ago, and he argued that all we really need is professional codes of conduct. And we computer professionals don't need to learn about ethics. As long as we have a good, robust ethical codes of conduct, that's all the industry needs. So that's a little quiz tip. Part of the quiz asks a question about what Donald Gottebahn's opinion on ethics and codes of conduct are. So that might help you with the quiz. So just a little bit more on Gottebahn's argument. He generally argues that codes of ethics are aspirational because they serve as mission statements for the profession. Codes of conduct are oriented more towards professional and the professional's attitude and behaviour. And then codes of practice relate to operational activities within a profession. So that's the kind of those, all of those things together make up the, you know, the spirit of what a code of ethics within a profession is meant to be. In the PowerPoint presentation, you'll see a page which has strengths and weaknesses of professional codes. I'm not going to read all of that out or discuss it too much. I think you should go and have a look within the PowerPoint presentation that goes along with this podcast. Have a look for yourself and you'll see there are strengths and weaknesses of professional codes. So that could potentially be a good exam question. What are the pros and cons of professional codes of conduct? Just a little tip there. Okay, so now we're going to look at the topic of whistleblowing. What exactly is whistleblowing? In which cases can we justify whistleblowing? And so on. The first thing we need to do is consider the concept of employee loyalty, because this kind of goes hand in hand with the idea of whistleblowing. So most of us would agree that employees and employers have a special obligation to each other, and that is one of some degree of loyalty. So if you're working for an organisation, it's generally expected that you would be loyal to your company and speak positively about your company and ensure its well-being and so on, right? And this kind of goes vice versa as well. So employers are expected to be loyal in some degree to their employees. So we could argue then, we might argue that employees have some special obligations of loyalty to their employers. This is not blind loyalty, of course. And there might be some cases when employees think that there are issues at stake to do with maybe safety and health issues, or where maybe some software is designed so badly that it's going to cause significant problems. And then there could be cases that we might argue that might warrant an employee blowing the whistle. So there have actually been some really famous cases where engineers knew that there were significant problems with particular systems, but didn't blow the whistle, and that resulted in the deaths of people. The famous examples that are discussed in the Tavani text are, first of all, the Challenger space shuttle example. So once an investigation was done on the space shuttle, they found that many, many engineers raised concerns about problems with faulty O-rings, but these, no one blew the whistle, and these were all just kind of pushed under the carpet. And then, of course, the Challenger space shuttle blew up on takeoff. And there's another famous example in the United States with a car called a Ford Pinto, and these had problems with faulty gas tanks in the car, and which meant that the car, many of the cars exploded after the gas tank exploded after relatively minor crashes, killing people inside the car in a fire. And so it was discovered as well that these problems were known by many engineers, and many engineers had raised concerns, but they were all ignored. So the problem with blowing the whistle is that you're potentially going to bring a lot of harm to your organization if you were to blow the whistle just over anything that you thought was a worry. So in the textbook, a guy called Richard DeGeorge in 1999 came up with this criteria when engineers should blow the whistle. And there are two sections to the criteria. One is when an engineer or employee is permitted to blow the whistle, and then a stronger version is when an engineer has a moral obligation to blow the whistle. So two sections. So DeGeorge's model, the first section is when is a person permitted to blow the whistle. So that means you might have concerns about something, you've raised those concerns with your supervisors or your bosses and so on. No one's taking you seriously or no one's listening to you, and then you are permitted, according to DeGeorge's model, to blow the whistle, which means maybe go to the media or tell somebody outside of the organization. So here's three criteria when one is permitted to blow the whistle, and that is when the harm that will be done by the product to the public is very serious and considerable. Number two, the engineers or employees have made their concerns known to their superiors. And then number three, the engineers or employees have received no satisfaction from their immediate supervisors. They've exhausted all the channels available, which might include going to the board or the directors or the senior people within the organization. So that's, if those criteria are met, then according to DeGeorge's model, an engineer is permitted to blow the whistle. Then he also argues that there are situations when we have a moral obligation to blow the whistle. So he gives two further criteria. And that is where he argues we're morally obligated to blow the whistle when the engineer has documented evidence that would convince a reasonable or impartial observer that his or her view of the situation is correct and the company policy is wrong. And then finally, that there is very strong evidence that making the information public will in fact prevent the serious harm that could cause. So that's DeGeorge's take on whistleblowing. Now, there are a couple of other takes, but given that this podcast's a little bit longer than I thought that it would go on for, I want to try and close it down there and just try and summarise the other alternative. So there is a guy called Ladd, 1991, who his argument was that we're placing too much requirement on people to be moral heroes, as he calls it. And then there's another alternative compromise view by a person called McFarlane, which is in the textbook and in the PowerPoint slides. So you should probably go and have a look at that as well. And that, I think, draws to a close this podcast number two. We have one more to go, podcast three, and I'm getting onto that right now. So hopefully you enjoyed this and learnt something. Make sure you reference, have a look at the PowerPoint slides as well. And as I said in the previous podcast, I think I'll put the notes up on Moodle as well. So my lecture notes should be there as well. See you in the next round.